Accession number 19766, Real 4.
Well, there was the Calcutta Swimming Club, which they used to send. They used to send a note to the battalion to say, you know, send so many of your troops along, and we can entertain them at the Calcutta Swimming Club. And that was great because it was a huge open air swimming pool, and those of us who were swimmers, and by now I was quite a good swimmer, we used to thoroughly enjoy it, you know. And that was the lighter side of it, but otherwise it was hard trading and all that sort of thing, and the beds the beds you slept on were iron bedsteads with metal crossing metal strips which you lay on, and where the metal crossed another metal, of course there would be bugs, and you'd lay on your bed and up there would be, you're all under mosquito nets, so your mosquito net would be rolled up and tied to the wire in the day, and you'd be lying on your bed perhaps in the afternoon when it was just so hot, you'd be laying on your bed and you'd see the bugs coming along the wires. I'm not exaggerating, they looked about half as big as my nail, you know, these little animals all trooping along, all for you. And they would drop on you sometimes, but you got used to it, you know. And every now and then you'd take your bed spring out onto the veranda. It's a big concrete building, this, the Fort William. And you'd bump it up and down to shake out the bugs. And then you'd have a little stamping exercise, like horses, you know, tread them in. I have to laugh about it. And poor old Fred, he had a big corn under his foot. Right the sole of his foot, he had a corn. And one morning, a little old Indian gentleman, all in white, with a white turban, a white beard, a real handsome-looking old grandfather-looking type, came in with a little bag. And he would ask as he came along past the beds if anybody had any problems with their feet. So I said to Fred, here's your chance. Tell him about your corn. Because he was in the next bed to me, was Fred. So Fred told him about his corn. He held his foot up. And it's right in the middle there, this corn. He used to play hell with him. So, yes, I can cure that for you. So he opened his bag. He brought out two or three little knives. Very, very sharp, obviously. Little knives, like a doctor's little kit. And he started to peel around the corn until he was satisfied that he'd peeled sufficiently away. And old Fred was... He couldn't feel it. Very, very deft, these people are. Very deft. And then he got a little tube out. About as long as that. As I remember it, a little black piece of rubber tube, or it looked like that to me. And he opened it out at the bottom, and he put it over where the corn was, and kept pressing it round at the bottom. And then he bent down, and he sucked the air out of it. But the tube stayed on the corn. And eventually, I don't know how long, what time the time was, but he took it out, and there was the corn, in this little tube. The suction had pulled the corn out. And Fred had very little trouble after that. I can't remember what he paid him, probably half an anna or a few annas or something. They can do things like that. I keep telling my wife I'd take her in there one day because she's got a nasty corn. It'll cure her. And what else was of interest there? They used to Indians used to come in and play tennis with the officers. They were marvellous tennis players. They'd be dashing about the court with their dhotis, flying in all directions. But they could always beat our officers. And then one day, There was not a request, there was an order to look at the notice board for certain names. As a number of chaps had to be sent to the Arakan. I can't remember the wording. But my name was on there. Not Fred. My name was there. And about 150 of us were to go to the Arakan. Now the Arakan, if you're not familiar with the names, is the southern part of the part of Burma which juts out towards India. And that was a campaign in itself, the Arakan. So there's about 150 of us, I think. We didn't know where we were going, except if we were going to the Arakan. So we were sent on leave. We were sent to whatever.
In the Himalayas?
Yes, yes.
Darjeeling?
Darjeeling. That's where we were sent, to Darjeeling. Oh, I'm glad you know these names. We were sent to Darjeeling. Now, that to get to Darjeeling is a wonderful thing to do. You travel across India to the foot of Darjeeling. Can't remember the name of the place now. It's Kuchi or some name like that. And it was hot. Terrible, terribly hot, of course. And then you get onto this little train, about that wide, not much longer, with these little coaches behind it. The train was made in Birmingham, a Brum train. Engine, rather, not a train, engine. And in the front of the engine, on either side of the boiler, was a box, were boxes, a box on either side full of sand. And there was an Indian perch there, each side. And as you went, and when the train started, you started to move up, and it was doing this. And the Indians were putting sand on the line, on each line, so there was an Indian putting sand on the line. And he went up and up and up, and it was getting cooler and cooler and cooler, and some of the trains went that way, and that had reversed to do that, so they had to go up that way. There was a reverse, and, you know, there were about two reverses, I think, if I remember rightly. Until eventually you get to Kalimpong, which was before Calcutta, Darjeeling, and then Darjeeling. And of course, there is cold. Well, not freezing, but cold, coldish. And by golly, you are up. And all around you was the most magnificent sight you have ever seen, Kanchenjunga, the mountain of which Everest is part of it. And it's all up there, as far as you can see, that direction and that direction, and right in front of you. Absolutely out of this world, really, as it is out of this world. It's up there, 28,000 feet. Well, we were only there for, I think we were there for 10 days or something. Only in empty houses. So we put our kit bags down, slept on the floor, which was, we were always used to that, of course. And then we used to go down. We only had enough sufficient money, really, to go to a cafe called Caventas. I can see it now. It was on the edge of two roads. A road went, did this, and Caventas was there. Some of the local people, there were still local people who run shops and little businesses, of course. They used to come up there and have coffee, and we used to go there and have our coffee. And if we were in luck, we'd have their cream as well in our coffee. That is, if they'd left any. So Caventas was famous, and we thought that was marvellous, because we didn't have a lot of money, but sufficient for that. Oh, and we drank gallons of Darjeeling tea, which is the only place to drink it, because I've never tasted Darjeeling back here quite the same. Not the same. So we were up there for 10 days. One of the most amazing things I remember seeing were the hill people, how they could climb from down there, and I mean down there, a long way down there, with a bag of coal on their back, which was nearly as long as they were, with a bandage round their head, going down their backs underneath the sack, and they could climb straight up. They didn't go that way, where the track was, or the road was, but they'd go straight up like that, carrying this bag of coal. Amazing people. Really are amazing. I used to watch them. I didn't know how I felt, really. I mean, there's no good saying I'll give you a hand, because they wouldn't know what you meant by that. They probably wouldn't want it anyway. But I thought it was great. And one day, I, being where I was and being the sort of bloke I was, I wanted to see a bit more of and hope to see Everest. Now, in the square at Darjeeling, there was a lot of people who owned ponies. So you read it in the book anyway. And they, for whatever price it was, you could take a pony, or they would give you a pony and saddle. I'd never been on a horse before. And take you up this track, so far up, where there was a hut, a few more thousand feet up. And I booked a horse for tomorrow morning at dawn sab. Oh, I'd be there. And I was there. I can't remember who else was with me. There was one or two other chaps, I think. But they got me on this horse, and I was holding on to this horse, and we slowly went up the track, walking all the way. So I was all right. I was walking. It took hours to get up to a certain point from where you could see Mount Everest. And we got to this hut, and we're looking around the hut, and there were various pictures of various other mountain peaks and things, and it was very interesting. Now, we were too early for the sunrise over Everest, so that's what we were waiting for. And then the sun came up, and it was absolutely out of this world. For the first time, it looked like an ice cream cone with a mellow sort of colour around it. And as it got bigger and bigger and bigger, of course, it turned into a snowy peak. But that was Everest. And it's marvellous, really. I mean, that's the place. If I wanted to go to India again, which I don't, but if I did, that's where I would go, up there, have another look at that. Terrific stuff. Anyway, we stayed up there for a while because you were timed, so to speak. You know, you had to be back by a certain time. I got back on my horse, and that horse didn't stop. I was all over the place. I swear I was under its belly on more than one occasion, hanging on, feet going out, feet in all directions, hanging on for grim life, until it got to the bottom. It took about a fraction of the time to go down as it did to come up. And then I couldn't find the owner of the horse when I got down there. But they said, oh, put the horse there. I said, oh, no, wait a minute, I've got my change to come. It is so much. And you give them so much in the first place. Oh, well, they didn't know where he was. I said, all right, I'll wait until he comes. So I waited, but there was no sign of the owner of the horse. So I took the saddle off the horse. I mean, this was somebody who was brought up with his mother's apron strings, but who's now relieved on them, you see. You're a different person. So I took the saddle off the horse, by which time there were various other people on this square. Holiday makers from the plains, you know, would come up there, and they were all standing around. And I said, I'm going to sell this saddle. Anybody interested? And the people moved forward a little bit. Nobody was really interested, but they probably wanted to know what was going to happen, you see. So I kept on, and I was threatening to sell the saddle or throw it over the edge, because there was a wall around, quite a drop, you see. So eventually the owner of the horse came up, and he came up with my change. But that's the only way I got my change back, by threatening to sell the saddle or throw it over the edge. So I got my change, which probably wasn't very much anyway, but to me it was quite a lot. But now that was my picture of Everest, and I've got snaps of it. I've still got snaps of it. And it's really worth seeing. And then came the day, of course, when we had to go back. So we kit again, back on the train, and wormed our way down, and it was getting warmer and warmer and hotter and hotter. And you reach a certain point where it whooshes in. It hits you in the face, the heat from the plains, and you're back where you came from. And you're stretched out there. Terrible. Oof. That was, and you wished you could go back, you know, but that was too late. Anyway, you've on and on and on, back to Calcutta. And then the lorries, all of us then gone onto various lorries, up to, I can't remember the name of the station. I can't remember the name of the station, but it was on the edge of the river, not the Ganges, what's the other?
Brahmaputra.
The Brahmaputra, on the Brahmaputra. And in came this huge, huge raft-looking boat, this big, huge, flat one. It could take a train, or carriages, or a carriage or something. So we were ushered on, crossed the Brahmaputra to Maiman Singh, or some names like that, the other side. And from there, we were picked up and taken to a little dock somewhere like Cox's Bazaar or someplace like that. I can't really remember the names now. Onto a ferry, which took us to the tip of the Arakan, the Indian end of the Arakan. And now we were in foreign, really foreign stuff. We were in the danger zone. So we all got off the ferry and marched. I don't know how long we marched for, I can't remember. But we were then joining somebody different. And they said, you, 1st Battalion, the Royal Barks. So I was now a Royal Berkshire man. You, 1st Battalion, Royal Welsh. And so it went. So we were all in, I think we were all split up between about 3 different regiments. I was in the Royal Barks, 1st Battalion of the Royal Barks. And then after marching so far along this track, we met up with the battalion who were there doing their stuff, so to speak. So we joined up with them, shook hands here and there, and officers said, "Now you go up there, you've got to join up with so-and-so. And we ended up on a knife edge like that. We were on this side, and the Japs were supposedly on that side. And we were right on the edge of it. And they are sharp. They're sharp ridges. They're not like that. They're like that. So you could actually get to the top and look over and look down. And we were on guard up there. I can't remember how long we were there for now. It's gone.
Which company were you with?
I can't remember the company I was with. I can only remember the battalion. It was the first battalion, the Royal Barks. But I can't remember what the company was. But I can't remember how long we were up there altogether. I think I was with them for about 3 months altogether. 3 months.
Did you see any action there?
No, we just heard it. And we were frightened every day, every time we were up on that ridge, because they used to talk to us from the other side. Every now and then you'd hear a Japanese voice telling us to come over. You know, come on, Tommy, you come over to us. You know, you can't do it. Nothing you can do about it. You come over. You know, we're going to win anyway. You know, that sort of thing. And that didn't make you feel any better. So, and then at
night...
Did
they call you Tommy or Johnny?
Tommy. I can only remember Tommy. They probably called Johnny as well, but I can't remember that. And, but when you see, you lay on this ridge with your rifle ahead of you, like that, and the least sound you heard on the other side, just like a leaf, that sort of thing, you'd tighten your grip on the rifle. But, and that was really frightening, you know, that was, you were glad to get off duty. And when off duty really meant sliding down from that ridge, just a bit farther down where you could have a sleep or a kip, as they used to say. And that went on, and we moved from there to other ridges and so on. And I think I think it was about 3 months, I never saw a Jap, just heard the noises, which was quite frightening, believe me. And one day, a lot of the Japs had got so close that we had to get out. So that was my first strategic withdrawal, as they kindly put it. You know, get out or else. So we got down from the Cuds, we call them Cuds, down onto a track at the bottom. We must have been all in, really, because we marched, and a Liverpool chap called Sammy Drinkwater was with me. We were together, and we kept falling farther back because we just didn't have it in us, you know. So we kept falling back until in the end, we must have taken the wrong track or something because we couldn't see anyone. And we really had a fright because we realised that we were on our own, Sammy Drinkwater and me. And as we were marching along, we heard a clip-clop of hooves. So we dashed into the undergrowth on the side of the track, guns forward, waiting and hoping. And it was one of our own officers who was looking for us. We'd apparently, there had been a bit of a fork road somewhere, and instead of going with, behind the troops, we sheered off to the left. So we were on our own. He'd come up this track from the other track. He said, now get up there or else, you know, we probably had a few more words than that to say. So we had to scuttle up and eventually joined the battalion. Where did we go from there now? We went from there. Eventually we got onto Garry's, onto lorries, and we went to Chittagong, I think it was. I think Cox's Bazaar. Either Chittagong or Cox's Bazaar. Why do those two names?
They're not far apart, really.
Well, one or the other of them. And I suddenly got something I couldn't get off the floor. Well, we were sleeping in old huts, mud huts. And I couldn't get off the floor. I tried to get up and I couldn't. And chaps helped me up and I fall back down again. And, oh, my God, what have I got? I didn't know what I had. No idea. So there was nobody in the battalion. The doctor didn't know what to do with me. So they sent a brigade HQ for a masseur. So this chap came up, asked me what was wrong and so on, told him I couldn't get up. So he turned me over and he started the massage caper. And I lived like that for 3 days. I was eating on the floor, eating what there was to eat. For about 3 days that lasted, and then it gradually disappeared. And it went. And that's all there was to that. I never knew what it was, except it might have been dampness from the floor or something like that. But, and then from there, we got onto the trains to go back to India. And we were on this train, filthy dirty. And my cousin who had come abroad with the Gloss, he was with the Gloucesters. He was somewhere in India, Harry. He was a signaller. But I didn't know where he was. We were on this train which had stopped, and it had stopped there for hours. And it got night time came along. Well, we kept down overnight, of course, on the wooden slats of seats. And in the morning, on another track just across from ours, there was another train. And the back of the train was sort of opposite me, and it was a sort of a guard's van. And I could see a mosquito net up inside it through the slats of the sides of the carriage. And I wondered to myself, who the heck would be sleeping in there? So we'd been stuck there overnight since yesterday afternoon, probably waiting for the boat to cross the river. So I decided I'd nip out and find out who was in there. So I nipped out of my coach, crossed the line, and reached inside and found a foot and pulled a big toe of this foot. And a chap leapt up from the other end and started to swear, you know. So it's all right, I said, it's all right, it's all right, I said. I'm in the train opposite. I said, we're all going back. Oh, he said. I said, what are you anyway? He said, I'm a signaller. Oh. And I said, you don't by any chance know another signaller, do you, by the name of Harry Windyatt? He said, Windy, yes, he said, he's the other side of the river. I said, are you serious? He said, no. He said, I'll call him up for you, if you like. So he called across to Harry Windyatt, which was my cousin. And when we eventually got aboard this big, huge raft thing and landed the other side, Harry was on the platform waiting for me. Now, what about that for a coincidence again? And, of course, I jumped out of the train, out of my carriage, seen Harry, and we shook hands and did the things that you would do. Because he was not only a cousin, he was a pal. We used to do everything together when we were young. And along came our Sergeant Major Peters, who said, now then, what do you think you're up to? I said, excuse me, sir, I said, but this is my cousin. He's a signal, and we've just met for the first time. Oh, all right, he said, but we'll be off in 5 minutes. So we had a chat for about 5 minutes, and that was it until after the war. Of course, he came out of the war, I came out of the war, so we piled up again. But... It just shows you how, you know, how things can happen. Anyway, we got back and we got on the train, and we were 3 days crossing India until we got to near Pune. A wooden seats, of course, nothing comfortable about them. You just sat on a wooden bench, and that was that for 3 days. We got to one place where we were going to stop to have a cup of tea and whatever was going, and it was fly blown. The air was thick with flies. So they decided they couldn't stop there. There was so much in the way of flies that it would be hopeless. You'd be eating flies. So we moved on. And there was a sugar refinery somewhere around, so they said. So we moved on to some other station somewhere where they were able to stop, and we had a, whatever it was, tiffin, so a snack, until eventually Ahmednagar. We eventually arrived at a place called Ahmednagar, which isn't far from Pune. Miles away, but India's a massive place. So, and it's another hot place. So, of course, we met up with our old pals from Fort William, because the whole brigade went there. So Smudge, who was with the Royal Welsh, and we got talking about our exploits in the... He didn't see any Japs either, but he had the same sort of experiences that I had, you know. So we had some good old chats there about the Arakan. So that was our first campaign, the Arakan.
Was it... You went with the Berkshires to...
Royal 1st Battalion... Oh, wait a minute. The 1st Battalion... Of the Royal Berks, that's right. The 1st Battalion of the Royal Berks, that was it. Of the Royal Berks. So, then they said, well, you'll be going back to your own, to your old battalions. We got a notice around. You'll be going back to your old, your old battalion, the one that you left. But first of all, you'll have a week's leave. So we were sent to Pune. So in this place, there were showers. There was a bathhouse, what they call the bathhouse, the loos and all the rest of it. So like others, I went to the bathhouse. And when I was in Africa, my stepmother had bought me a belt, a lovely, soft, beautiful, soft leather belt, which was hollow inside, a money belt, in other words. So when I took my clothes off, including my money belt, my savings, in other words, would have been in there. And when I came out, when I finished whatever I was doing, it had gone. So I lost everything. I lost everything money-wise. That was the end of that. So I reported to the company office that I had no money, and no point in me going to Pune. So I think I was allowed a certain number of rupees, probably about 5 rupees or 10 rupees or something like that. 3 to the pound they were in those days. So I did go to Pune. And all I did in Pune was once again go to the cafe, sit in a cafe. Oh, I had a photograph taken. I had my photograph taken. That one that's on the cover of my book. It was the one I had taken in there, actually. So I just had enough money to go and sit in a cafe and have some coffee. And then back to Ahmednagar, where we then got on a train for Assam. Now, on the way to Assam, we went through various Indian towns or cities, and we picked up quite a lot of Americans. And there are all sorts of